you for inviting me here. Many of the people you will hear today are legal scholars. I am not. I am a political sociologist by training. My book outside deals with practically every issue you're going to hear about today, but I am going to focus on the chapter which compares the social movement for reparations to Africa, to the social movement for reparations for Jewish victims of the Holocaust. I just want to mention before I do so that I wrote this book with the assistance of Mr. Anthony Lombardo, who was my research assistant at the time. Okay, so we did when we did our book, we read a lot of speeches from the Durban 1 conference against racism. We interviewed 76 African ambassadors, activists, and academics, and so on and so forth. And many of these people asked the question, why did Jewish victims of the Holocaust obtain reparations, but we can't? Ali Mazrui is a Kenyan-American, and he says in his book, how do 12 years of Jewish hell compare to several centuries of black enslavement? So, I use the definition of reparations in this book that Professor Van Boven came up with for the United Nations, and I include in that book acknowledgements, apologies, symbolic reparations, and financial compensation. But the question that was normally posed to us was about financial compensation. And our answer then lies in social movement theory. So this is theory about how the question is framed. The key word here is framing, so that it persuades not only those seeking reparations, but also those from whom reparations are sought. So it's a kind of symbolic politics, and there's a need for emotional and moral resonance to convince those from whom you seek the reparations. Now, the African diaspora movement so far is quite small. In 1992, the then Organization for African Unity, appointed what it called a group of eminent persons, which were 12 eminent people who were supposed to take charge of seeking reparations for slavery and colonialism. But that group was never very active. Although this matter still seems to be on the agenda of the African Union, and I have had an inquiry from somebody involved in that from Africa about this. Reparations then is being taken more seriously in preparation for Durban 2 in Geneva next April. There are a few small groups in London, Kenya, Ghana, Jamaica, and then the one major book of advocacy by Professor Mazrui. In social movement theory, we call people seeking reparations for slavery an unmobilized sentiment pool. A pool of people that have the same sentiment but are not yet well organized or well mobilized to seek that. So, when you think about framing, when you think about framing this matter, many African reparationists or diaspora reparationists think that the claim for reparations for the slave trade is self-evident, because they think all you have to remind people of is the brutality of the slave trade. I am not a novelist. I cannot convey to you in this talk the brutality of the slave trade. I recommend to you the novel by my African-Canadian colleague, Lawrence Hill, called The Book of Negroes, which is a brilliant evocation of the slave trade. But people think that given the numbers and the brutality, it should be self-evident that reparations should be paid. Many reparationists think this is the worst human rights travesty in history. It is not. Stalinism is estimated to have killed 30 million people in Russia. 20 to 30 million people died in China during the Great Leap Forward alone. So it is not. It is one of many terrible, terrible tragedies in human history. So I'm not going to present you now with my assessment of the moral claim. What I'm going to do is talk to you about tactics. My own beliefs, which I present in the last chapter of my book, is that in the larger view of things, Africans are owed acknowledgments, apologies, museums, memorials, better education on both sides about the slave trade and colonialism. I think a better frame for monetary compensation, however, is economic human rights, not reparations, because it does not require quantification of historical responsibility for the slave trade, and quantification of that responsibility is a very difficult question. All right, so here are some key aspects of how you make a successful claim for reparations. First of all, you have to have an identifiable claimant. Certain types of harms are especially ones that are likely to get compensation. The harm is illegal at the time it's committed. It violates bodily integrity, death or physical harm. It violates equality rights and perhaps violates property rights. You also need a short causal chain, the chain of cause, from the final event, say an individual being enslaved, and everything that went before. You need identifiable perpetrators or respondents. You need a finite number of perpetrators. The evil has to be caused by human action rather than structural causes. It has to have taken place during a discrete period of time, and it has to be a discrete act within a short period of time. It's also useful to have a condensation point, one key story which makes the whole episode obviously morally wrong to the public, and that is because people, to a large extent, think in stories. You tell them 100 or 800,000 people died in the genocide in Rwanda, they don't react. You tell them the story of the lady who watched her 7 small children killed one after the other, the last one saying, "Please don't kill me, I promise I'll never be Tutsi again," and you remember that, right? And the claim has to be reasonable financially. Okay, this is not my saying this is how it must be. This is what I have and my assistant distilled from the literature on successful social movements. So here, let's look at the Jewish victims of the Holocaust. Now, one thing that you may not know, first of all, is that Jews were not persecuted only between the period 1933 and 1945 in Europe. Jews were persecuted for 1,000 years. The Jewish claim for reparations does not cover the massacres, murders, expulsions, and so on when the Jews were accused of causing the Black Death in 13, whatever it was, 49 or 69. It does not cover all the pogroms that took place in Eastern Europe. This is important to remember because many people think that the Jews only, in quotations, suffered for 6 or 7 or 12 years. This is not true, but this is the period for which Jews sought reparations. Okay? So there are two waves of claims. One is immediately post-World War II, and the other is in the 1990s for slave labor and so on. Identifiable claimant, Jews, or those whom the Nazis considered to be Jews. The Holocaust dead, the survivors of the Holocaust, and their first generation post-World War II heirs. They were represented effectively, and this is one of the problems with the African movement, by the State of Israel and the Unified Claims Conference of, I believe, 52 Jewish organizations. Types of harms. A little bit questionable whether it was illegal at the time or whether the Nazi regime was at least within its rights in Germany to kill people if it felt like it. So there's a big debate about when genocide became illegal and whether the Nuremberg trials were retrospective justice or not. Definitely violated bodily integrity, murders, slave laborers, torture, medical experiments. Definitely violated equality rights. Jews were declared non-human and violated their property rights. There's a short causal chain here. Identifiable perpetrators, the Nazi state, and later its various collaborators. A finite number of perpetrators. Again, the Nazi state, the Nazi apparatus, and its collaborators. Definitely caused by human actors rather than structural causes. If you look only at the period of the actual Holocaust, the maximum time period is 12 years. You can shorten it to the 4 years of actual extermination policy. And there are condensation points. For my generation, and even for younger generations, the condensation point is the story of Anne Frank, the Dutch girl who wrote a diary while in hiding until she was murdered. For second generations, we have a TV program in the United States in the 70s called Holocaust. We have the movie Schindler's List, which brought the Holocaust to people's attention again. And by standards of what taxpayers will put up with, the claim was financially reasonable. The estimate I've seen is that by the year 2000, $47.6 billion were spent on reparations, which is less than $1 billion a year. So that's also very important by contrast with some of the claims that African reparations make. Now, look at the African slave trade and you see how difficult it is following these criteria. First of all, the question of an identifiable claimant. Well, Paul Lovejoy, a very distinguished scholar of the slave trade, says 11.3 million people were taken across the Atlantic in the transatlantic slave trade. If you add those who died in the Middle Passage going across the Atlantic, you get to 13.6 million, and unknown numbers died within Africa. Now, how do you identify the claimants now? Do you look only for the direct descendants? Do you look for all of Africa? Do you look for all of African American, all of the African diaspora? You can use things like slave ship records and historic documents to find out some direct descendants, but not all. Question of whether the harm was illegal at the time. For a large chunk of the slave trade, it was legal. Slavery was fine in law. The UK abolished the trade in 1807, the US in 1808. The UK abolished slavery itself in 1838 and the US in 1863. Not until 1925 was slavery abolished worldwide. The harm did definitely, of course, violate bodily integrity. It violated equality rights by our standards, but not by the standards of the time. It violated property rights and bodily integrity and in stolen labor, but the European traders did not take over land or property in Africa. The really big question here is the causal chain. It is very hard to identify the perpetrators and who might then be their lineal sort of legal descendants. The perpetrators include, but are not limited to, private European individuals and corporations and governments that permitted or encouraged the trade. But they also include African sellers and intermediaries. And there's also the problem that there was a slave trade out of East Africa to the Middle East. There were Arab slave traders. Some of the people I interviewed were far more angry at the Arabs than they were at the Europeans, because they came from parts of Africa where they were raided, or their ancestors were raided for slaves by Arabs. There is not a finite number of perpetrators. It is true that this is a matter, the slave trade was caused by human actors, but the condition of Africa today is very much also a consequence of structural causes, such as political and economic relations, both internally and with the rest of the world. The period of time is 440 years. That's a very long period of time. Another problem is that we don't have a really good sort of condensation point. We have the movie, the series Roots, that came out in the United States in the 70s, but doesn't seem to have had the resonance that one might have expected. There was a film called Amistad. You might have thought it might have been the sort of African version of Schindler's List, about a historical incident of a slave rebellion on a slave ship and a consequent trial. Very little effect. And then finally, what is the claim for reparations and is it reasonable? Well, so far, it isn't. There was a conference in Accra, Ghana, a few years ago, and they asked for $777 trillion, which is a magic number. The US gross domestic product last year was $14.5 trillion. So this makes no sense. It is many times the US gross domestic product. One scholar named Osabu Clay asked for $100 trillion, but he asked for compensation for all the Africans who were never born. Now, if the Jewish community had done that, I think I did some math, we would be up to 30 million extra Jews, and we'd be asking for a lot more money, or the Jewish community would be asking for a lot more money in that case. So the problem here is that no respondent public would consider these figures, would not take them seriously. Now, when you get to colonialism, this conference is also on colonialism, it's a little easier. Right? You have identifiable claimants, all the inhabitants of the colonies since the takeover by Europeans and their descendants, and some of the victims of colonialism, many of them actually, and their direct descendants are still alive. Now, on types of harms, we're still in a little bit of a difficulty. Colonialism was legal until about 1960. Sometimes the bodily integrity of Africans who were colonized was violated, most notably, for example, in Congo. But in other cases, colonists protected Africans, for example, from ritual murders. Their equality rights with regard to Europeans were certainly violated. But on the other hand, some Europeans imposed equality, for example, by freeing slaves. In settler colonies, especially, the Europeans violated property rights. Forced labor, which was employed by many colonialists, also violated property rights. You have a shorter causal chain here. You have identifiable perpetrators, the colonial powers themselves. But you have a problem of collaborators, because some African chiefs, for example, did collaborate with colonialists. And sometimes colonialists would favor one African group against another, and the one that was favored would be happy with that. You have a finite number of perpetrators if you're only looking at states. If you look at private institutions such as corporations and churches, then it's more difficult to get reparations. Yes, this was caused by human actors. It's not quite a discrete act. The actual colonial takeover was discrete, but if you look at all colonial activities, it's not all that discrete, and it's a longer period of time, for example, than the Holocaust, because it starts in the late 19th century and ends in 1990 in Namibia. There is no... Sorry, I should put that up there. There's no, again, no particular condensation point. It sticks in people's minds about colonialism. And again, the question would be, what would be a reasonable claim? There's a further problem, which I didn't discuss in my book, which is that governments could simply argue, European governments, that the payment of foreign aid is in effect compensation. Now, despite this, it is possible to find successful cases, or cases that might be successful, for reparations, but these come from discrete activities during the colonial period. So the genocide of the Herero in Namibia between 1905 and 1908 is a kind of analog to the genocide of the Jews. So 65,000 out of 80,000 Herero, it is estimated, were killed by German colonialists. There was an extermination order. It said, we will take no one, we will leave no one, we will kill men, women, and children. The Herero argue that even if genocide itself was not illegal at the time, because we didn't get the Genocide Convention until 1948, the laws of war, they were at war with the Germans, prohibited their mass murder. The Germans have acknowledged this, and the German Minister for Development apologized in 2004. However, here we get a complication. The Herero would like reparations. The Namibian government says no. The Namibian government says, Germany is our chief foreign aid donor. We don't want them slicing off a big chunk of the foreign aid pie just to go to the Herero. And you have the further complication that the government of Namibia is composed mainly of people from Ovambo, who are a different ethnic group. The Hereros have, however, sued particular companies, including Verma Linea, which was a shipping company which they accused of having run its own concentration camps and benefited from slave labor. And again, their situation is analogous to the Jewish case. Known perpetrator, known and small number of victims over a discrete time period, and violation of the right to life. So when you get these cases, you sometimes are able to get reparations. But look at the case of Congo. Right. Congo should fit, but nothing's happened. Adam Hochschild, in his book, King Leopold's Ghost, basing himself on reports in the early part of the 20th century, claims that 10 million people were killed by Belgian colonists who were interested in extracting rubber, and who, in order to do so, resorted to murder, amputations, and tortures of Africans in order to force them to collect rubber. Now, historians dispute this number, professional historians of the Congo, but certainly there was a massive exploitation there. The Belgians have apologized for complicity in the murder of Patrice Lumumba, the first president of independent Congo, in 1960. And they have also apologized for not intervening in the genocide in Rwanda, but they have not offered any apologies for their activities in Congo, or at least they hadn't done by about a year ago when I finished my book outside. Nevertheless, we have here an identifiable claimant, all Congolese descendants of the late 19th, early 20th century colonialism and slavery. The harms committed were illegal at the time, if they included slavery, at least for some of that period. They did violate bodily integrity. They certainly violated equality rights, and they violated property rights. You have a very short causal chain. You have identifiable perpetrators. Now, the Belgians might argue that at this time it wasn't a Belgian colony. It was actually the private property of the King of Congo, of the King of Belgium. But you could argue that it was the Belgian state that kept the king. They could have said, you're gone. Or they could have said, you can be the king, but you can't rule Congo anymore. And they didn't do it. We could argue that analogous to the Holocaust, there was a finite number of perpetrators. This was caused by human action. It was a fairly discrete period of time, still much longer than the Holocaust of the Jews. But it was several decades, it wasn't several centuries. We have a condensation point. We have this book, King Leopold's Ghost, by Adam Hochschild. We don't have a movie based on it. Maybe that's what we need. If this were to become a compensation movement, there would have to be a reasonable claim. And there would be the further difficulty of who would be paid. Would it be the Congolese government? What Congolese government? Do we wait till there is a proper Congolese government? And so on. So the last case I'd like to just discuss is the case of reparations from Britain for treatment of alleged and real Mau Mau rebels, so-called, in Kenya in the 1950s. And this is a case that I think, if you look at social movement theory, has a fair chance of success. Okay, so the British, during the period of the Kenyan independence war, according to Carolyn Elkins and other scholars, rounded up suspected Mau Mau, but also rounded up their families, entire villages, women, children. They hanged people, they tortured them, they subjected them to cruel and degrading conditions, they castrated men. The list goes on and on. So these harms, were they illegal at the time? Well, yes, sort of. International and European Union law, human rights law, was just evolving at the time. By late in the Mau Mau period, the British had signed on to some human rights documents. Very early in the Mau Mau period, they hadn't. They certainly violated bodily integrity, as I have just described to you. They certainly violated equality rights. These African prisoners were not treated as human. And they violated property rights. The British settlers had taken the property of Africans during the period of colonialism prior to the insurgency. There's a fairly short causal chain here. There are identifiable perpetrators: the British, colonial troops, and the Kenyans who worked with the British. But that's a problem I'll get to. Fairly finite number of perpetrators. Again, human actors. This didn't have to happen. The British could just have said, okay, you want your independence, fine, you can have it, as they didn't quite do, but they did in other colonies. It was a discrete act over a short period of time, 10 or 12 years. The condensation point for us as scholars and for the educated public is Carolyn Elkin's book, Imperial Reckoning, which documents in quite a dramatic fashion, because she talked to a lot of survivors, what had happened to them. A reasonable claim, I think, is being made by the Mau Mau reparations group in Kenya. Now, they're not asking for $100 trillion. They're not asking for $2 million per survivor. And you will hear later, I think, how small, for example, in the case of the Holocaust, how very small the amounts are to individual survivors of the Holocaust. So if my analysis is correct, the Mau Mau reparations claim should have good prospects. But the British claim that Kenya, the successor state to the colony, the British colony Kenya, is now the responsible actor for reparations. So then you have to go and look at internal politics in Kenya, as you do in Namibia. And in Kenya during the 1950s, there was a Home Guard, and the Home Guard fought on the side of the British. And those people are still around, or their allies or descendants are still around. So if you start compensating the Mau Mau, the Home Guard may say, we want to be compensated. Mau Mau also committed atrocities. So there becomes a very complex politics, which is also then bound up in ethnic politics in Kenya today. So, as I said, my book deals with many of the questions you will address today, but I thought the one thing that probably nobody else would talk about was social movement theory. So I've tried to give you a quick hop through social movement theory, and I believe I can take questions. Is that right? Does one of you want to share in case there are more than one question, or comments or criticisms?
Thank you very much, Professor Howard Hassman. We have about 15 minutes for some questions. It's been very stimulating. Permit me just to say that I have opportunity for questions. Perhaps we'll take two or three at a time, and then you can respond to them. I saw one here. Are there any others? Two, one at the back. Okay, please.
Hi, thank you, that was really helpful and nice to start to I was interested, you're saying that about finite perpetrators being helpful, and I was interested in the case of the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust and the Nazis, in the debate, I mean, was anyone ever talking about sort of the whole German people, because there's that whole thing of complicity and not rebelling against the government that's doing these things? And I mean, obviously that can be applied to other historical cases as well. But I was wondering in the debate over, you know, which is a smaller, finer thing to discuss, in the debate over the Jewish Holocaust, was there any consideration given to that, the responsibility of individual Germans?
So, first question, there's a second one at the back.
Thanks very much indeed. Questions. The first question is, could you comment on the recent settlement of Italy and Libya in regard to colonialism? I'd just be interested to hear your views on that. My second is a more substantive question. I was intrigued by your use of law in your presentation. So, for example, you suggested that it wasn't clear whether something was lawful or not, but then you go on to assert that it was, for example, a violation of property rights. So I was interested in that juxtaposition between something that was law. It wasn't clear to me whether you were talking about international law, for example, or domestic law. Expropriation of property in Kenya under colonial law would have been fine, for example. So I don't know where you get your rights from at that moment, some natural law or some other international law, I'm not sure. And thirdly, very specifically, your condensation points, you sort of made me nervous. Because you asked me, like, sort of a Hollywood film idea or some, you know, historian or something.
Sorry, what did you just say?
It seems to be either a sort of Hollywood film idea, the Schindler's List, so I was wondering about the purchase of these condensation points, but particularly the Elkins book, because as far as I knew, that was quite discredited by other historians. If you look at David Anderson's History of the Hanged, for example, which is seen to be the superior book and actually called, you know, sheds great question marks over Elkins' book. So I was interested, first of all, the idea of condensation points would kind of worry me, but secondly, the specific ones that you chose, in particular with regard to Elkins, seriously worry me, because the facts and the history of that book would be so
clear. Okay, that's for you to go.
Okay, so the first question from the lady in the front. No, the social movements discussion doesn't look at the entire German people as being culpable. That especially comes from Daniel Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, but I think we're looking here at legal and governmental responsibility. And Professor Nathan, or Mr. Nathan, has left the room for the time being, but he's one of those people that negotiates. So you negotiate with the people who have the actual legal responsibility. Had that been the approach after World War II, then I think that all the negotiations would have got bogged down because they would have said, well, nobody has responsibility because everybody has. In the 1990s, you get the second wave of claims against banks in Europe and insurance companies and so on. And so you have sort of collaborative people who are responsible. The other lady at the back, three questions. I can't comment on Italy, Libya. I will take this opportunity to give you a commercial for a website called political-apologies.wlu.ca, which I run, and on which I put as much as I can primary documents and press documents. You're right about property rights. I will immediately go home and change this presentation. I should have just said violation of property, not property rights. You're right, it's quite legal to take over African property under colonial rule. There, in natural law, I would assume there is an idea of a property right. Certainly in African law, those Africans who lost their property thought they had the right to it. But I take your point. On condensation points, it's not whether we as individuals find this palatable or not. If you're looking at social movements, you're looking at how you generate a social movement and what makes people upset or angry enough to take actions. So you can have social movements about things that we would really rather there was never a social movement at all. Elkins wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book that got a lot of press. So from the point of view of the reparations movement, that is much more influential than the critics. And the critics had various views of her books. They weren't all condemning it. That's much more influential. And Elkins wrote in a style that was accessible to the educated public. Lots of individual stories. And again, that may not be palatable to us as scholars, but you have to think of how you get a social movement going. So the idea of condensation point actually comes from a brilliant colleague of mine named Alison Brisk, who was doing this kind of research on how you get a social movement to go.
Are there any other questions? We've got about 5 more minutes. Yes, please.
I think that the U.S. reparations movement for African Americans is easier, in part because they have something which I didn't mention earlier called policy venue. Where do you go for the policymakers? Well, for in the United States, you go to the U.S. government, right? So the U.S. African Americans are citizens of the United States, and their policy venue is the U.S. government. But again, I wrote somewhere else a comparison of the African-American movement with the Japanese-American movement. Japanese-American movement is analogous to the Holocaust. Very short period of time, clear perpetrator, limited number of victims. The people who got compensation were still alive at the time, and so on. And so the question in the United States is, you know, who is an African-American? Is Barack Obama an African-American? Or is he an American-African? His father's from Kenya. He's not descended from slaves. Right? Whom do you compensate? How would you compensate them? My private view, which I may make public someday, is that the African Americans are owed a great, big, huge, enormous apology, full day, apology by the president, etc., etc. My private view is that there should be a Museum of African American History on the Mall in Washington. There should be a lot more museums and memorials all over the place. It shouldn't be African Americans putting up their own memorials, which often happens. And a very large sum of collective compensation would be appropriate. So I would say, you know, give them 1 year's worth of military expenditures in Iraq, something like that. and have a group of distinguished African Americans to oversee it for education or housing and so on. Also, when you get to the Jim Crow period, it's analogous to the colonial period. There are still veterans of World War II who were not given proper GI Bill benefits when they came back, who were redlined when they were seeking mortgages. So, I mean, I think all that would be a much more analogous case and easier. Now, I might write this even though I'm not American. My next project in this line is to write an article about an apology to African Canadians, who also didn't exactly get a wonderful deal.
Thank you. Perhaps clarify, if I'm not mistaken, Alison Risk, is she now at the University of California?
Yeah, Irvine, yeah.
Irvine?
Yeah.
And she's just written a couple of interesting articles about specifically social justice and international relations and the mobilizers of it. I forget exactly where it published, but you can look her up. We have, yes.
Just a quick one. Just
this one at the back.
I was talking to a Canadian friend of mine a while ago about this, and he was using these young people who are giving so much money, sort of when they turn 18, and this is what he said, I have no idea, I haven't looked into it myself, yeah, that they then didn't really go out and get a job even half the time, but this was his opinion. So I was wondering on your comment on that and the comparison there.
Should we just take the other two questions? The first, just, yes please.
Yes, I just wanted to make two points, actually. You touched on the one of the points I was going to make, which is about the sort of idea of hierarchies of the reparations movements, and perhaps the way that one particular movement, for example, for reparations to slavery, might serve to displace other good claims. I'm thinking, for example, in the case of Native Americans in the US, and I'm following what's happening now in Canada in relation to First Nations people, where there seems to be a difference between what's happening in the US and what's happening in Canada. The other issue for me is on the question of who is the compensation for. If this is largely a reparations movement for the descendants of slaves in the US, that's a very different issue from the question of fair trade deals with Africa and so on. So I think it's crucial to decide who it is you're trying to compensate. If it's about Africa, that's one thing. But if it's actually about descendants of slaves in America, something completely different in terms of what we do about it.
And then last question, just at the top.
Yeah, I just wonder if I could use your presentation a bit to frame what I think is the problem we have in this conference and might sort of continue for the rest of the day. But it seems to me we've got a conflict between a concept of justice on the one hand and law on the other. And it's a conflict we always face when we deal with historical injustice. Because it's the lawyers, we run up against a problem that what was the law for at the time might not seem very just. So I think there's a conflict, tension between justice and law. And I'm surprised that social movement theory, also replicated that conflict. I thought you might take us past it by ignoring law in favor of justice. But in fact, one of your criterion is that it must be illegal at the time. But that seems to be something that's really critical to your theory. And I'm surprised at that, because that's the lawyer's problem. It's lawful at the time, so how do we give reparations to something that was lawful at the time? And that's the problem we're going to have in this conference. But this is a plea for social movement theory to take us beyond that a bit by addressing more the concept of justice, because if we get stuck with law, we're not going to get past much of the first session.
I think you've been grappling with that for a while, right? I remember reading some of your pieces before. So, 3 or 4 points.
Okay. I think no Canadian in her right mind would make a scholarly comment on treaty rights and other rights of Native Americans if she hadn't been studying them from the age of 2, which I haven't been doing. It's far more complicated than saying, let's give pots of money to young Aboriginals. And there are treaty claims, which are legal treaties as well. So. Hierarchies of movements, that can become a problem. Right? And that's why I think it's very dangerous to get into competitive suffering games. Native Americans have different problems and different legal statuses than African Americans. I separate the African American movement from the African movement intellectually, because I think the African American movement I think it will be easier for African Americans to mobilize and to fit the kinds of criteria that social movements theorists bring to our attention. However, with regard to fair trade, I think that should not be considered reparations. Fair trade is fair trade. Economic rights are economic rights. I would rather, this is what I advocate, say, regardless of who is responsible for the sufferings of many Africans in Africa now, regardless of the historic responsibility, we have a collective responsibility to protect the economic and other rights of Africans today. I think that is more efficient than having long, huge wrangles about who's responsible for 5 centuries of suffering, because that responsibility includes African collaborators in the slave trade. It includes 40 to 50 years of highly abusive post-colonial rule by Africans themselves, which is in a large part responsible for the difficult economic conditions. So my view would be, don't debate it, just get on with it. And you do that because we already have an international law of economic rights. And I think if you start saying that economic rights, fair trade, and all these things are parts of reparations, then you're getting into a big intellectual tangle. And it's going to have very detrimental effects. With regard to the last question on the law, I hope I didn't say that the actions must be illegal at the time. I hope I said if they were illegal at the time, then social movement theory predicts that the mobilizers will have an easier time getting their claim recognized. I am not a social movement theorist. I am a human rights scholar. So I am only using theory and applying it to the cases I have dealt with, which is 4 cases overall in my published work. It's easier if you can say, at this point, when this was being done under your own law, it was wrong. Doesn't mean you can't get reparations. In the case of the Jewish victims of the Holocaust, it was not illegal in Germany to kill their own citizens prior to 1945, when they nevertheless got reparations. Again, justice versus law, I mean, I'll leave that one to you. I'm somebody who's very interested in law, but I came from an unjust world where exactly 1% of law students were female at the time I was considering a career. So I'm not a lawyer. All right.
Thank you very much, Professor Harkins.